Hi, I'm Michael Spare, and as Ian said, every word I say now is being recorded. So we'll see how this goes. This will be fun for me, and it should be fun for you. You can have a choice, I guess, when you get home of listening to, you two or Michael Spare. You know, it's your choice. When you go to the gym, you'll see what you want to put on. This is the core class in health policy and management. It's a pretty large class, as you could tell by looking around the room. I think there are 222 or so that were registered before today. That number will probably, shift a little bit upward or downward. I'm not sure, but it is a large class. We have a syllabi that we've passed out. If you haven't received one, you can get them. They're up on Coursework, and we'll also have them available at the break. We have 5 teaching assistants in the class, in part because it's such a large class. And I'll put there at the break, I'll also put their names and email addresses on the blackboard, but I'd like them to stand now. They're sort of in this corner right here. There's Brian Wilson, Elena, Brian, why don't you raise your hand, will you? That's Brian, Elena Tobin, Katie McKee, Monica Ray, and Namardian Kumarasma. Oh, I got his name. Somewhat close. Sorry about that. These guys will be available to you on email and also available to you to chat with about anything you want having to do with the class. And they'll be helping me with grading of your various papers. The goal of this class is really twofold. It's first to provide an introduction to you into the evolution of the healthcare system in the United States. How did we get the kind of healthcare system we have? How did we get the kind of health insurance system that we have? How did we get the kind of medical workforce that we have? How did we get the public health system that we have? A basic introduction to how did we end up where we are today? What's sort of the historical roots of that system? The second goal of the course is to walk you through some key issues on the political agenda for healthcare today in 2006. So actually, if you look at the syllabi, you'll see that after doing some historical material today and next week, we'll be talking about the uninsured, we'll be talking about Medicaid and Medicare, we'll be talking about the new Medicare Drug Act, we'll be talking about managed care, long-term care, public health, quality of care, health information technology, and we'll also be taking a quick look abroad at the healthcare systems of some other nations and how they compare. Obviously, we can't cover everything. It's an introductory course. One of the things that I try to do, since we can't cover a lot of things in this class, is have you pick a topic to write a research paper on that is something of interest to you. For example, we're not going to cover in any depth at all in this class mental health policy. But if you're really interested in mental health policy, I'd like you to write a paper on mental health. We're not going to cover HIV/AIDS in South Africa. But if you're really interested in sort of pharmaceutical companies and HIV and developing countries and what's happening, I'd like for you to write a paper on that. So the largest single requirement for the class in terms of requirement is that you write a 12 to 15 or so page research paper on a topic of your choice, and I'll be sending around over the next couple of weeks some guidelines and some ideas and some thoughts on the paper. But that's one of the linchpins of the class, and is a way for you to try to pull in some of your interests into material that otherwise may not be your first choice of things to study. The other requirements of the class are 3 relatively short papers, 5-6 page papers, which will be spread out over the course of the class. I think one is on the uninsured, one is on comparative health care, and one is on suing your health plan and sort of the legal issues around managed care liability and wrongful denial of care and the like. I'm curious, I know in the fall semester here at the School of Public Health, students in the Department of Health Policy Management are generally required, unless they have some reason why they can't, to take this class. And in the spring semester, we often have students from other departments, other schools, and the like. Just to give me a quick sense, are there any HPM students in the class this semester? Okay, so there are a handful of HPM students. And then how about sort of other, I just, again, to give a sense, putting together biostat, epi, environmental, the various other departments. If you're in one of the other departments in the School of Public Health, could you just raise your hands? Give me a sense. Okay, so as you can tell by seeing the hands, a large majority of you are not in HPM. And how many students from other schools are there here? Are there other students from other schools? All right, and then there's a handful of students from other schools. So I recognize that the few of you that are here in HPM, somehow I got out of taking this class last semester, but you're stuck in it this semester. And everybody else from the rest of the school is here in large part because you have to take the class, because it's a required class. And I also recognize that it's Monday night, and it's 5:30 to 8:30 or whatever it is, and that many of you work and you're going to be tired. And I also recognize that this is going to be podcasted, so you could sort of, you know, skip class and stay home, I suppose. But what I want to do is try to figure out how I can make it as interactive with you, given that we have 220 people here, as interactive with you, and how it could be as responsive to some of the interests and issues that are important to you, so that you actually, well, it won't be your favorite thing to do, you won't mind showing up, you know, Monday nights for a couple of hours to sit in this class, and that actually that'll seem better than sitting at home in your room and trying to make your way through a long, boring podcast. Let me tell you just a little bit about my own background and some of the kind of work that I do. I started out practicing law here in New York City, and I practiced law for about 8 years. A good chunk of that time, what I did was I represented New York City in lawsuits when the city was suing other levels of government. So when the city was going to sue the state, or the city was going to sue the federal government, I got involved in those kind of lawsuits on behalf of the city. A lot, and you'd be amazed at how much intergovernmental litigation there is. A lot of those lawsuits involve the nation's social welfare system. For example, I spent years working on a case in which I was representing the city's hospital system and the city's public welfare system, in which the issue in the case was whether or not undocumented aliens, undocumented immigrants, would be eligible or could be eligible for Medicaid benefits. There was a federal regulation, a federal law, which said that if you were an immigrant to the United States, the only way you can get Medicaid benefits was either if you had a green card in effect, or if you were what was known as permanently residing in the United States under color of law. Only nobody knew exactly what that meant, permanently residing in the United States under color of law. Nobody had a clue what that rule meant. And so from the city's point of view, all we knew was that there were millions of dollars being lost, in our view, because thousands of undocumented immigrants would show up at the emergency rooms and at the clinics of New York City hospitals and New York City clinics. They'd be low-income immigrants who would be eligible for a program like Medicaid, but for the fact that they weren't United States citizens and could not prove that they were residing in the United States under color of law, whatever that meant. And so we brought a lawsuit with some legal services officers and with some others challenging the exclusion of undocumented immigrants from the Medicaid program and challenging that whole criteria of permanently residing in the United States under color of law. We won the lawsuit in the Eastern District of Brooklyn, and a federal judge in Charles Tipton struck down the federal rule saying that if you were an undocumented immigrant, you can only get Medicaid if you were permanently residing in the United States under color of law. And so the next day, there were headlines in the New York Post and the Daily News and the like saying, illegal is eligible for Medicaid. The day after that, not surprisingly, the Congress of the United States decided they wanted to try to overturn the decision by the judge in New York because the members of Congress didn't like the idea that undocumented aliens were going to be eligible for Medicaid coverage. So then, as lawyers for New York City, we shifted our hats from the judicial branch to the legislative branch and got involved in the lobbying effort down in D.C. and ultimately worked out a compromise in Congress under which if you were an undocumented, under which the permanently residing of color of law rule was put back into the law. In fact, we agreed to overturn what the judge had said, or to, you know, put back into the law what the judge had said. But we got an exception, and the exception said that any undocumented immigrant who shows up at an emergency room, the cost of the care, of emergency care for undocumented aliens, would be covered by Medicaid. And so from the city's point of view, it was a big victory, legislatively, ultimately, because most of the money that the city was spending on undocumented immigrants was in the emergency rooms of city public hospitals, and they would now get reimbursed from the federal government for that money. So it was a big victory. On the other hand, from a public policy perspective, it probably was pretty bad public policy to basically say that, you know, Medicaid will cover emergency care, but it won't cover any primary care, it won't cover any preventive care, it won't cover any outpatient care, it won't cover any physician care. The only thing Medicaid will cover for undocumented immigrants is emergency room care. And so from a public health and public policy point of view, what was good for the city actually turned out, I think, to be not such good public policy. Working on that case and others like it, in which there were these battles between these different levels of government, I got particularly interested in the ways in which the different levels of government here in the United States worked with each other, shared burdens, shifted burdens, took responsibility, tried to get other people to pay for their services, and the like. And so I decided at that point to go back to school myself, and I went back and got a PhD in political science. And I got that in 1991, I guess, and then I came here to the School of Public Health at Columbia in 1992, and I've been here ever since. And what I do is I write and study about the politics of healthcare, and I try to think about issues involving different levels of government, who's got responsibility for what, and how it all turned out the way it turned out. And so a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about in this class are topics that are of particular interest to me in my own work and my own sort of, you know, daily activities. So I think it's important to try to keep up not just with what's going on in this class, but to recognize that these political issues are changing every day. There's decisions right now being made around the Medicare drug bill. There's decisions right now being made around the uninsured. There's decisions right now being made about emergency preparedness, which I think are very much a part of this class, very much a part of my work, and at least for the next 4 months, I think very much a part of your work. And so one of the things that I would like you all to do, which you may well probably do already, but if you don't, then for the next few months I'd want you to try, which is to read the New York Times when there's an article about healthcare in the New York Times. If you read the Wall Street Journal, read the Wall Street Journal when there's an article about healthcare. If you're really particularly interested in looking at more depth, I point out in the syllabus some additional places you can look to follow what's going on. The Kaiser Family Foundation has a free website which has a daily health policy reporter which will tell you more than you want to know about what's going on in the United States in a range of areas every day around the politics and the management of the healthcare system of the United States. So I want you to try to keep up with what's going on. We're going to be talking about what's going on here in this class. And over the course of the semester, we're going to try at times to break you guys up into smaller groups. We have probably three times over the course of the semester when we're going to break out into breakout groups with various questions for you to consider. And again, we're going to try to be as interactive as we can in a class this large. Any questions so far on any of the mechanical things? Have people bought the book at the bookstore, anybody? There's one book and it's available at the bookstore. There's copies of it there. If for whatever reason the bookstore runs out of books, let me or let one of the teaching assistants know. I see some people have the course pack, which is a Village copier. If anybody has trouble getting a copy of the course pack, let me or let one of the teaching assistants know, and we'll make sure that we can, you know, we'll make sure to get more books and get more course packs. We're going to try to use CourseWorks over the course of the semester to keep you updated on what's going on in the class. We'll be posting assignments. We'll be doing a variety of things with CourseWorks. So be sure to try to keep track of CourseWorks over the next several weeks. That's the place where you'll see information about what's happening here in the class. Any questions so far? All right, the way I'll run the class is we meet at 5:30. We'll probably start, say, 5:35, no later, each week. We'll go for 75 minutes or so, take a short break, then we'll come back. And we'll probably end around 8:15-ish. If I look around and you're all looking absolutely exhausted, we may end a few minutes early. If I look around and you're just looking totally enthralled, we may go till 9 o'clock. I mean, that's kind of up to you. We'll have to see how that goes. I mean, last semester we stayed till midnight, but you don't feel any pressure. I really liked those class last semester, too. No, I'm just... All right. What I want to do now is take you back. I mean, again, we're going to be talking plenty over the course of the semester about current issues in healthcare, politics, and management in the United States. But it seems to me that in order to understand, or at least understand well, the politics of 2006, you have to understand and you have to know the politics of 1787 and before here in the United States. You have to understand the institutional framework that guides the American political system. You have to understand a little bit about American political culture. You have to understand a little about some of the ideas and some of the historical evolution and historical roots of the healthcare system. So my goal today in this first lecture, in this first chat with you guys, is to take us basically from the 18th century pretty much to the New Deal. And then next week, we're going to go from the New Deal and spend the first half of the class going from the New Deal to the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, and then we're going to spend the second half of the class next week talking about Medicaid and current issues in Medicaid. But again, we're not starting with HMOs, and we're not starting with the uninsured. We're starting with the roots of American history. And indeed, when we start with the roots of American history, I'm not even going to start with Americans. I want to start, and again, you know, one of the things that I know is when you cover this much material, when you try to cover the roots of American history in an hour and a half, 2 hours, you have to do it very quickly, and I won't say superficially, but you have to do it at least very quickly and cover material in less depth than one might otherwise hope and want to do. Feel free to stop me and ask me questions if I'm going either too fast in terms of the material I cover or if what I say doesn't jive with what you learned in high school history or high school philosophy or if you took a college class or a PhD class. If you're confused about something or if you disagree with me on something, again, feel free to stop me at any point. But where I want to start is actually with a couple of British philosophers in the 17th century, late 17th century, early 18th century, named Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. And the reason I start with Hobbes and Locke is that they were part of a movement in the 17th and 18th century, part of a philosophical movement, which began to change the way we think about the relationship between citizens and government, about the relationship between the governed and the governors. Prior to that era, most political philosophers, and certainly most rulers, whether they were kings or monarchs or popes or whoever, most rulers basically said, you know what, there's a natural order to things. Nobody has natural rights that are independent of the state and independent of society. Everybody, in effect, has something of a preordained role in the society, whether your preordained role was a citizen or a slave or a philosopher king or, you know, whatever you happen to be. Everybody has pretty much a preordained role. and that there was no such thing as individual rights. What Hobbes and Locke and others, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and others of that era, began to argue was that at core, individual rights come before government. And that the relationship between citizens and government is one of what they called a social contract, in which the citizens, in effect, figure out what kind of government it is they want, and then create that government and create a contract with the leaders, and either write it down on paper or at least have it implicitly set forth among them. Now, for Thomas Hobbes, his view, and many of you probably remember this from some philosophy 101 class you took, but his view was that without government, life would be, in his famous phrase, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So basically, it would be kind of miserable and anarchical. And so we create government as a cop, in effect, to maintain and preserve order. We do it. We do it voluntarily, but we do it because it's the only way we know how to preserve order in society. John Locke, L-O-C-K-E, had a different view. John Locke had a different view. Locke thought, you know what, things won't be as bad as Hobbes was talking about if we didn't have government. But, said Locke, there would be some what he called inconveniences. And the main inconvenience, the main problem, according to Locke, was that without government, it would be hard for us to preserve and protect our private property. And we have an individual right, said Locke, that precedes government. We have an individual right to the protection of our private property. And so, said Locke, we create government primarily to protect our individual rights, in particular our right to private property, but our other rights as well, to freedom of speech and expression and the like. So government is a trustee for us. Government is there to protect us. Government is a necessary evil. In an ideal world, we wouldn't need government. But we do to protect our individual rights. But the role of government should be limited. The role of government should be limited to protecting individual rights. So for Locke, he had a very different view of government than Hobbes. Both had a social contract approach, but a different view. For Locke, government ought to be limited in power, designed to protect individual rights, and if indeed government usurps its power, if indeed government acts arbitrarily, if indeed government, instead of protecting our individual rights, threatens our individual rights, if indeed government violates our individual rights, then we as citizens of a particular country have a right to revolt. So those guys were both writing late 1600s, early 1700s. Let me switch from Philosophy 101 to American History 101 now and talk a little bit about what was going on in the colonies, in the American colonies, in the 18th century. The British Empire was expanding dramatically in the 18th century. Expanding dramatically. But Britain was also engaged in ongoing battles and fights with France in particular. Spain at times, but France in particular. They had just an endless array of wars back and forth. I mean, I think they still, I have a sister who lives in France now, and she's lived there for about 25 years, and so her kids are French, in fact, I guess. And when they come to the United States, I mean, you could still tell they like hate the British, you know, and it's like the British, I mean, there's still this sort of ongoing tension, I think, between many of the countries in Europe. And in particular back then, there was this ongoing battle between the French and the British, and largely because of those battles, the Brits basically decided, you know what, we're going to let our colonies sort of pretty much govern themselves in the early part of the 18th century. You know, we might have some rich British guys, you know, who be the proprietor of Pennsylvania or have some, you know, ownership of some of these colonies, but basically we the Parliament, we the King, we're not going to worry too much about what's going on in the colonies. And so the British sort of exercised relatively little oversight and authority through much of the early 18th century over the 13 colonies as they grew at an increasingly rapid rate here in what we now call the United States. This all changed, however, in 1763. In 1763, for a short period of time anyway, the Brits and the French worked out a treaty, worked out a period of peace. So they were no longer fighting with each other. And part of the result of the peace treaty in 1763 between the Brits and the French was that the British economy began to tank because it had been a war-based economy. And the British economy began to tank and British revenue began to decline precipitously. And the Brits started to have real financial trouble, ironically, because they'd worked out this peace treaty with the French. At that point, in 1763, the Brits said, you know what? We've got these colonies which are generating a lot of money. And they've been acting pretty independent recently, and they've been doing okay for themselves. And perhaps a good source of revenue would be the 13 North American colonies. And so in 1764, the Brits imposed what they called a sugar tax, significantly increasing the amount of money charged to the colonies when they imported most goods from abroad. Then in 1765, some of you probably remember reading and hearing over the years about the Stamp Act, a British law that basically said just about every piece of paper that was transacted in business here in the colonies had to contain a British stamp. You had to buy that stamp from Britain, put it on the piece of paper, and obviously it was a huge revenue collection tax for the Brits. These taxes in the 1760s, upset vehemently the colonists here in the United States, here in North America. They were used to pretty self-autonomous regulation. They considered themselves part of the British Empire, many of them did, but they didn't have the right to vote in the British Parliament. And the notion that the Brits were going to make up for their revenue shortfalls by imposing these significant taxes on the colonies here was not a notion, as you can imagine, that was popular here. So there was a huge uproar in the colonies against these taxes. There was an equally huge uproar against a number of other activities that the Brits engaged in. The Brits passed a law in 1765 that said, in effect, if there's a British soldier who needs a place to stay, you have to let him stay on your property, so-called quartering act. The Brits passed a law which limited the ability of the colonists to expand westward. So there was a series of these acts which were viewed as harsh, as arbitrary, as inappropriate, as wrongful and as especially upsetting because the colonies had no voice in the British Parliament, had no voice with the British throne, had no ability to influence, to check, to try to challenge these efforts. There were riots, particularly in the Boston area. Yeah. This was the first so-called direct tax that had been imposed by Britain ever. And so after the Stamp Act was, and so after the Stamp Act was enacted, generating huge opposition here in the United States in 1765, the opposition was so strong that Benjamin Franklin went before Parliament and basically made an impassioned plea to Parliament to repeal this tax. In 1766, the Parliament actually repealed the Stamp Act. So they did respond to that outcry, but at the same time, they imposed a whole series of other taxes and other requirements which were unprecedented according to the colonists here and were generating huge opposition. So you had this big political battle beginning to be generated. Again, going through very quickly, you know, the idea this is not, you could spend, and lots of classes do, you could spend a whole course on just this one early period in American history, and obviously we can't do that. But there were other pivotal moments, many of which took place in Massachusetts, which was sort of the hotbed, you know, all those, you know, early Red Sox fans, you know, they sort of were very aggressive types there, and, you know, a little obnoxious, you know, just sort of, you know, it was just in their blood early on. You know, there was, there were riots in Boston in 1770, led to the so-called Boston Massacre, in which half a dozen or so British soldiers were killed. There was another tax on tea that was imposed, and then you all remember hearing about in some class, I'm sure at some point in your life, the Boston Tea Party, when the colonists get on the boat and they masquerade and throw the tea off the boat. You know, there were these various sort of mini-revolts that took place. Again, as I say, primarily in the Boston, Massachusetts area, but which were generating support in other parts of the country, although concern. I mean, there was a real internal debate going on among the colonists, and there were about 4 million folks who lived in the 13 colonies at that point, so it's not, you know, the hundreds of millions that we have today. There was, and about 95% of those 4 million were farmers or worked on farms in very small urban areas. I mean, Philadelphia was the biggest city back then. I think it had about 23,000 citizens at that point, whereas London had about 700,000 citizens, just to give you a sense of scale. I mean, we were very small, very, very small. And there was real concern and debate on the one hand among some who said, you know, all this revolt, all this rebellion, it's going to get us nothing but trouble. You know, we're a tiny group of colonies. We have this, you know, 3-4 million residents. Britain's got this huge navy. They've got this huge population. They could wipe us out in a minute if they wanted to. And what we really want is just voice. You know, we want to be considered British. And no taxation without representation, or whatever the phrase was. You know, we don't want independence. We can't survive on our own. But we want voice. Versus those who were saying, you know what, the Brits have acted arbitrarily now, and if they're acting arbitrarily now, it's only going to get worse over time. We have, while a relatively small population here in the colonies, just an extraordinary opportunity for expansion and growth. You know, there's a tremendous amount of land here that's underdeveloped and open for expansion. And if we can really have control of this country, control of these colonies, we could really have just a, you know, a strong, self-sufficient, economically powerful set of nations ourselves. One of the most important keys to remember here is that part of the reason there were distinctions among the colonies in terms of how they were responding to some of these initial events that were going on, these initial battles between, you know, some of the folks in Massachusetts and the Brits and some others, is that the citizens of the 13 colonies viewed themselves as citizens of those states. They viewed themselves as New Yorkers, or as Pennsylvanians, or as Virginians. they did not view themselves as so-called Americans, whatever that meant. There was no notion of these colonies as a single nation. Instead, there was a notion of 13 mini-states, mini-nations, aligned together, affiliated together, in their opposition to what was viewed as arbitrary and inappropriate and unfair action by the Brits, but real distinction among them in terms of what was the appropriate course of action, what was the appropriate response, what was the appropriate way to handle this and move forward. After the Tea Party incident, though, in 1773, the Brits, for their own internal reasons, decided they really needed to clamp down on what was going on in Massachusetts. And so in 1774, the Brits actually occupied Boston. They basically took Boston over with troops. They brought all these troops over on the Navy, and they took over the town. Again, at that point, the other colonies, while they did not view themselves as Massachusetts folks or whatever the slang is at heart, they were extraordinarily upset that the Brits were now taking over one of the 13 colonies, one of the states. The fear was that the Brits would take over all the colonies at that point. So in response to that, you had called the First Continental Congress here in the United States, the first time the 13 colonies bring together delegates to talk about how it is that they can respond or how it is that they should respond to this British activity, this British takeover in Boston, these British taxes which are now being imposed, this British Quartering Act, these British soldiers that were now wandering the streets everywhere. What was this going to mean, and what was the appropriate response, and how should this play out? Again, just to walk you through real quickly the next few steps. In April of 1775, the Brits decide they're going to arrest some of the leaders of the Massachusetts Rebellion. They're going to arrest John Hancock and Sam Adams. Sam Adams was more than a beer back then. He actually was a revolutionary leader. They're going to arrest these guys. That's when Paul Revere, you know, says, oh, the British are coming, you know, Adams, Hancock, got to be careful. And battles break out in 1775 in Lexington and Concord. And then shortly after that, the Continental Congress meets for a second time, and that's when they appoint George Washington, the Virginian, to lead the National Army against the Brits. Even then, there was still real division within the colonies as to whether or not fighting this war for independence made sense, whether or not it made more sense to try to work out a deal with the Brits. But the Brits were not interested in working out a deal at that point. They wanted to stamp out what they viewed as a rebellion. Yeah. Absolutely. No, they were representatives from Massachusetts as well. So at that point, in effect, the war basically begins. 1775, the War for Independence. The war goes on for 7 or 8 years. It's a long, difficult, brutal war. Ups and downs and ups and downs. There's lots of books. I mean, early American history has become relatively popular. Sort of on the bestseller list these days, if you want to read books about whether it's Benjamin Franklin or John Adams, Alexander Hamilton. I mean, there's biographies of all those guys these days. In fact, I think tonight at 9 o'clock, depending on your preference, you can go home and either watch Jack Barrow on 24 Save the World, or you can watch John Adams and Abigail Adams on Channel 13 Save America. You know, it's your choice. During the course of those 8 years, during the course of that battle from 1775 to 1783, a lot happened that shaped, again, both American political culture and American institutions and American history. First, in 1776, Thomas Jefferson takes the lead. He has help from a bunch of others, and he drafts the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration builds right off of John Locke, the British philosopher. The Declaration declares, right near the beginning, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." Again, that notion of certain unalienable rights was a brand new notion in sort of world history. "That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men," not women, that took a while, "deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, a social contract. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." So basically, Jefferson and the drafters of the Declaration say, we want to create a new social contract. We don't want the bricks as part of our contract anymore. Following the issuance of the Declaration, the 13 colonies, the 13 mini-states, the 13 mini-nations all put down on paper in some of the earliest recorded written constitutions in world history, put down on paper the relationship between government and citizens in their states. They draft what are known as state constitutions. Every state in the United States still has a state constitution. Those state constitutions today in 2006, in many respects, are the same documents with amendments that were drafted in the late 1770s and early 1780s. Let me ask you, when thinking about the institutions of government, when thinking about the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, the various branches of government and their relationship to citizens, what do you think those state constitutions would emphasize? Where would they place power? Where would they be hesitant about placing power? What do you think? Excuse me?
Executive.
What about the executive? Would they want power in the executive or not? They would not. You're exactly right. The state constitutions drafted extraordinarily weak governors. The state of Pennsylvania abolished its governor. They didn't want governor at all. They didn't want, the notion was, we're not fighting a war with the British only to have a new monarch or a new king in New York or in Boston or in Virginia. We want democracies. We want power to be vested primarily in the legislature. We want clearly defined bills of rights which set forth our individual rights. In fact, even today, if you look at many of the constitutions, many of the state constitutions here in the United States, many of them vest primary power in the legislative branch and have relatively weak executive branches. And the ones that have strong governors and strong executive branches are either states that came along much later or states that have amended significantly their state constitution. The state of Texas, for example, has an extraordinarily weak governor. Now, of course, Texas wasn't around, wasn't one of the first 13, but early in American history, most states wanted weak executive branches, weak governors, and strong legislatures, and strong bills of rights. And that became a theme, and that became an institutional reality in American, early American politics. So you had these state constitutions being drafted. At the same time, we were fighting a war. The 13 colonies were fighting a war with the British. They were borrowing money from the French and others to help finance the war. There were ongoing border battles between the colonies. We were incurring a significant national debt. We did have George Washington running a national army in addition to the state militias. So the question arose, shouldn't we have some form of a national constitution as well as these various state constitutions? Shouldn't there be some document that binds us together as a country, the same way that the state constitution binds the state populations of the states together and the citizens of those states together? But at the same time that there was a proposal for a national constitution, there was significant opposition to it as well. Again, the notion was, we're not fighting a war with the Brits to have a new monarch that rules the 13 colonies. We're not looking to transfer power to someone here. We're not looking, if we're a small state, if we're New Jersey, which was a small state, we're not looking to have Virginia, which was a big state, rule the roost and tell us what to do. We are 13 separate states, 13 separate nations, 13 separate colonies that are bound together in their opposition to what the Brits are doing, that are bound together in the goal of independence from Great Britain, but view themselves as 13 separate nations with 13 separate currencies, 13 separate cultural approaches to the world, very different approaches to the issue of slavery, very different approaches to a lot of issues. 1777, the Continental Congress proposes something called the Articles of Confederation, which was not a new constitution, but was instead simply a statement of affiliation, a statement of agreement between 13 independent states, 13 independent nations. It took 4 years for the Articles of Confederation to be adopted. They were proposed in 1777. They weren't adopted until 1781. It took 4 years for the states to agree. And you know what? Those Articles of Confederation, they didn't create a new nation. There was no president under the Articles of Confederation. There was a national congress, but each state, each colony had one vote in that congress, regardless of the size of the state, regardless of the population of the state, one vote in that congress for each state, and it took 9 votes to do anything significant policy-wise. Very weak congress, no president, no power to tax. I mean, this is what they took 4 years to enact, to create. No power to tax, and a clear statement in the articles that the states had the right to trump any law that the Articles of Confederation Congress, the Continental Congress, passed that the states didn't like. Basically, the Articles of Confederation created a weak affiliation. You know, a weak agreement to share some resources. But it certainly did not create a nation. As George Washington was engaged in leading the troops toward the end of the 1770s and beginning of the early 1780s, and as those troops had ups and downs, and seemed to be winning the war, then losing the war, then winning the war, then losing the war, you know, and you could follow the whole trace of American revolutionary history if you want. During those up and downs, Washington complained over and over and over and over and over again that his ability to fight the war was handicapped significantly by the fact the federal government had no power to tax, no power to raise money, and no power over the states. Washington said, you know, how can I fight a war with no centralized leadership? How can I fight a war when I don't know what these other state militia are going to do? How can I fight a war when it's not clear at all who's in charge? Where? When? How? Well, he figured out, obviously, how to fight that war, and it was something of a war of attrition, and ultimately fighting a war so far from home, and, you know, it was difficult for the British, and Washington ultimately adapted also some guerrilla warfare type approaches to warfare, and ultimately, by 82, 83, the Brits were ready to give up. So the war ends. It really ends in 82, officially ends in 83. The war ends. The question then becomes for the colonies, all right, we've now won this war. We, the 13 colonies, are independent. Isn't it time now to create a constitution? Isn't it time now to create a national government? Isn't it time now to say and set forth the principles that bind together the 13 colonies? Isn't it time now to write a national constitution? And again, the answer was a resounding no. A resounding no. There was no interest on the part of the majority of Americans. There was no interest on the part of the majority of state leaders. There was no interest on the part of the majority of the returning soldiers to put together a national constitution. Instead, the idea was, let's continue under the Articles of Confederation. Let's continue with 13 separate semi-autonomous nations. Let's continue to have states have the ability to write their own currency or create their own currency, their own money. Let's continue to let states be able to borrow directly from France or European nations if they wanted to do so. Let's continue to let states enact taxes and tariffs and impose them on other states. New York's economy started tanking, so what did New York did? They imposed a tax on New Jersey and Connecticut, all goods in New Jersey and Connecticut. Not a bad idea, but it wasn't great for relations between New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. There were border disputes. The federal government was basically broke. The national income in the late 1780s, probably true for all the years, I just saw the reference to 1 year, but the national income equaled one-third of the interest on the national debt. The feds couldn't even pay the interest on their debt. They borrowed all this money from France. They borrowed all this money from Spain. They had all these debts. The rationale was, the way they were going to raise that money, they didn't have the power to tax, but they asked the states to contribute money to the federal treasury based on the size of the state. And if the state said yes, they got the money. If the state said no, they didn't get the money. They had no power to compel the state to give forth that money. So this system becomes increasingly chaotic in 1784, 1785, 1786. Increasingly chaotic. You've got these 13 separate little nations. You've got no national leadership. You've got these states operating in a system where they've got very weak executive leadership. They've got legislatures which have term limits and a sort of proud of the fact that they have citizen legislators and all that stuff, and the farmers come and they take a turn in the legislature and they go home, that every year the rules were changing, so there was no stability, or very little stability. So in 1786, James Madison goes to the Congress and says, goes to the Continental, this weak Continental Congress, and he says, you know what? We need a conference. We need to bring together delegates from the various colonies, the various states, just to talk about how we can improve trade relations between the colonies. We just want to figure out how we can improve economic relations between the different colonies. So the Congress says, okay, that's a good idea. Hold your conference. See what ideas you come up with. So in 1786, Madison holds this conference in Annapolis. 12 delegates from 5 states show up. The rest of the states just boycott it. They don't even send anybody. They're not interested. Now, that was 1786. Less than a year later, in May of 1787, 12 out of the 13 states send delegates to Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention, what we now call the Constitutional Convention. What happens between 86 and 87 to actually lead the elites of the country and the leadership of the country to decide that enough was enough and that we really needed to make some fundamental changes in the way the 13 colonies operated and that we really needed a national constitution? It's clearly a question you could read lots about, take lots of classes on, spend lots of time on. Sort of the quick and dirty answer is that I think the elites began to get scared. And the leaders began to get scared. In very early, late 1786, early 1787, an ex-Massachusetts militiaman who'd fought valiantly during the war, the Revolutionary War, never really been paid, goes home, never gets paid the money he's due, and he and a whole bunch of other farmers, all of a sudden they got no money, the economy's tanking, banks are foreclosing their farms, and basically these guys started saying, you know, what did we fight this war for? You know, we fought this war, we didn't really get paid, many of us gave up our lives or our family or our friends for our independence. We're just simple farmers, we've lost all our money, and now the banks want to take the money from us, take our property from us. You know, is this independence? Is this better? Is this good? And again, many of you probably remember from the studies of early American history that farmer, whose name was Daniel Shays, gets together a couple of thousand other farmers, and they create their own little pretend army. Now, they didn't really have the ability to do much damage. You know, they would kind of march around, and they would hold formations, and they would threaten to take over various, you know, buildings and offices in Boston and elsewhere. But they weren't really doing that much of anything. Yet, the leaders, the elites in Massachusetts became terribly threatened and terribly afraid that there was going to be, in effect, this kind of working class uprise and working class revolution among these farmers and others. And so they put together this huge paid army to sort of wipe Shays out and wipe his militia out, which they do. They win this sort of mini war. But again, there's a recognition that things are falling apart, that the center is not holding, that there's lots of these mini revolts, and that the mini revolters was sounding a lot like the revolutionaries themselves just a few years previously. And so the Madisons and the Hamiltons and the other leaders of the day begin to say, you know what, something is not right here. And so they go back to Congress and they say to Congress, you know what, we need another convention, not to create a new national constitution. They knew they weren't going to get permission for that, but they need a new convention to strengthen the Articles of Confederation, figure out how to improve it in significant ways. And that's the convention that's held in May of 1787 in Philadelphia. and goes on for several months in Philadelphia. That's the convention that Patrick Henry and other leaders of sort of the agrarian movements around the United States are very suspicious of. That's the convention that Henry says, I smell a rat. You know, they're not just looking to strengthen the Articles of Confederation, they're looking to create a new national government. This battle between centralization versus decentralization, versus sort of elite authority versus sort of mass democratization, that battle begins to shape up very clearly, very clearly. In any event, 12 of the 13 colonies, all except Rhode Island, send delegates to Philadelphia in 1787. And the delegates meet there for 4 months, over 4 months, in secrecy. Pretty young. I think the average age was 42. Madison was 36 at the time. Alexander Hamilton was 30 at the time. You know, young guys, 55 men. And they meet. And there were lots of issues that they had to try to overcome during those 4 months. And I'm just going to mention three of them quickly now, and then we'll take a break. But let me just mention these three, and then after the break we'll talk about sort of post-Constitution. One issue that they had to deal with right from the get-go, right from day one, if there was going to be any sort of national constitution at all, was the issue of slavery. As I mentioned, there were about 4 million folks living in the colonies, 13 colonies around that time. About 700,000 of them were slaves. In some of the southern states, slave population represented a little over a third of the population of those states. But even in the northern states, such as Pennsylvania, slaves constituted over 10% of the population. And there were slaves in New York, and there were slaves in every state, every colony. But the northern states, those states were moving during that era to abolish slavery, while the southern states were increasingly relying on slavery as the basis of their emerging plantation economy. And so the Virginias and the Georgias of the world and the South Carolinas basically said, you know what, we'll come together and we'll meet in Philadelphia. But we view ourselves as Virginians, not as Americans right now, or as South Carolinians, not as Americans. And if there's any effort on the part of this body here in Philadelphia to abolish slavery or to clamp down on our ability to import additional slaves, the deal's off and we're going home. At that point, the framers, and again, this is a bit of a tangent for us, but at that point, the framers came up with three compromises in the Constitution around the slavery issue. Anybody know what any of them are? Anybody remember any of the compromises around slavery? How they sort of dealt with that issue? Yeah. Close, three-fifths. One of the really, and this is sort of, it's really pretty amazing. There was this debate that goes on because, you see, the Southerners, the South was saying, you can't ban slavery, and you've got to let us have our slavery. And then the North is saying, well, if we're going to agree not to allow you to continue with slavery, if we're going to have a legislative branch which is going to be based in part on population, we don't want to count the slaves as part of your population. Because the North was worried that you know, counting the slaves was going to increase Southern control of the legislative branch. The South says, well, we don't want to give the slaves any rights, but we want to count them in our population so we can have more authority and power in the legislature. And so ultimately, they agree, and I'll actually read you the agreement. They never use the word slavery. But the Constitution states, and this was repealed after the Civil War, but until the Civil War, the Constitution stated, representatives in the legislative branch and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, in other words, whites, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians. So basically, Indians counted as zero. Native Americans counted as zero. 3/5 of all other persons. So in that kind of innocuous sounding language, you know, representatives shall be apportioned by adding to the number of free persons 3/5 of all other persons. With that language, basically, the constitutional framers agreed that to the extent that power in a legislative branch was going to be based on population, when you were adding up the population of a state, you would count 3/5 of all the slaves in that state as people. Or each slave would count as 3/5 of one person in adding up the population. So that was one of the compromises on slavery. Yeah. Well, that wasn't in the original Constitution, but that was actually, yes, I mean, you're right, over the next period of time, as the country began to expand, there were clear agreements that every slave state that was added, there would have to be a free state added, and that became very important to the Louisiana Purchase in the early 1800s and all that stuff. So you're absolutely right, that became an issue in terms of expansion later, but that wasn't in the original Constitution. The other two in the original Constitution, there's a provision in the Constitution that says that once this Constitution is enacted, we can't even discuss, and a Congress is created, and a presidency is created, we can't even discuss the issue of slavery for at least 20 years. You know, it's sort of off the books. So Congress can't even discuss it. So there's a provision that was in the Constitution that states the migration, again, it doesn't use the word slavery, the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. So in other words, Congress would not even be allowed to consider a ban on importation for at least a 20-year period prior to the, you know, after the Constitution was ratified. And that became a very big deal because shortly after the Constitution was ratified, Benjamin Franklin and some of the other abolitionists began a movement in Congress to try to ban the importation of slaves and to eliminate slavery. And the Southern delegates rose and said, you know what, we just made an agreement in the Constitution itself that this issue was not even going to be discussed in the Congress for at least 20 years until 1808. And Franklin and the abolitionists were silent based on that. And then the third agreement in the Constitution around slavery basically said that if a slave escaped into a free state, or if a slave escaped from his slave owner, the free state had to return that slave to his owner. It says, no person held to service or labor in one state escaping into another shall therefore be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor shall be due. So clearly, at the top of the agenda at the Constitutional Convention, although rarely spoken about, was the issue of slavery. And that was sort of the conflict, because again, if you read the Declaration of Independence and the language of the Declaration of Independence with its notion of all men are created with certain inalienable rights and on and on and on, and you try to square that up with the Constitution that in effect explicitly or at least implicitly authorizes and permits the continuation of the practice of slavery, under which 700,000 out of 4 million in America were in bondage, there was a clear conflict there, obviously, and that conflict ultimately grew larger and larger and larger and culminated in the Civil War. That was one issue that was dealt with. Second issue that was a key issue at the Constitutional Convention were battles between the little states and the big states, between the Virginias and the New Jerseys. the big states, obviously, wanted representation based on population. I mean, Virginia had 10 times as many people as New Jersey. And so clearly, they were much better off in any sort of system in which representation was based on population. And Madison proposed a plan under which representation would be based on population. The small states, obviously, were afraid of being swallowed up by the big states. And in effect, of being taken over by the big states. And so the small states wanted to continue the approach that the Articles of Confederation had adopted, i.e., in effect, one state, one vote, to preserve their influence, to preserve their independence. The compromise, obviously, the so-called Connecticut Compromise, was that we have a House of Representatives, which is based on population, and a Senate, in which every state has the same number of representatives. Whether you're North Dakota or California, you have two senators. I think North Dakota has one member of the House of Representatives and two senators. So clearly, in the Senate, the small states, on a per capita basis, have significantly more influence than do the big states, which becomes a big issue that we're going to talk about. For example, just to give you one quick example that's going to come up in a few weeks, when we talk about public health and bioterrorism, and we talk about the distribution of bioterror funds and how those funds should be distributed among the 50 states, one of the biggest issues are the battles between the big states and the small states in terms of how those monies should be distributed. And the small states have done pretty well in the distribution, largely because they have power that exceeds their proportional power, or what their proportional power would be if it was based simply on population. And it's not just obviously the Senate and the Congress. I mean, the Electoral College was a compromise between big states and small states. Every state, when it comes to electing members, electing presidents, every state gets the number of votes based on the number of folks they have in Congress. So that obviously gives small states a bit more proportional per capita representation than big states in the Electoral College. And it creates, situations such as we saw a couple of years ago with Bush versus Gore, when you can have one person win the popular vote and somebody else win the Electoral College vote. It created, speaking of slavery and civil war, created in 1876, you had a situation in which the governor of New York, Samuel Tilden, was running for president against the governor of Ohio. Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes. Tilden wins the popular vote. It's unclear who won the Electoral College vote. Big battle, big dispute, blah, blah, blah. Ends up going to the Congress. This is right after the Civil War. Hayes basically tells some Southern representatives, if you guys vote for me for president, I'll pull the troops out of the South, pull the Northern troops out of the South. Hayes becomes president, even though Tilden won the popular vote, and Reconstruction ends, and the Northern troops are pulled out of the South following that election in 1876. So clearly the Electoral College and the composition of the Congress, these institutional legacies are clear legacies of the battles between big states and little states, with tremendous implications today in 2006. Third key issue at the Constitutional Convention, really key issue, and they were all really key, but a third big issue was battle between federal power versus state power. And maybe what we'll do, since it's about 12:07, maybe we'll take a short break now, and then we'll come back and talk about federal state, and then pick up the story from there. Right. Take about an eight-minute break or so. All right, guys, we're going to start back off. I can have your attention. Are we back on? Back on, huh? All right. Is this on? Could you hear me in the back? Is this... this working? Could you hear me in the back with this?
Yeah.
Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to start back up. I've got between my walking mic here and my little iRiver thing here, whatever this is. We'll see. Okay. Now, I know there are a few people sitting on the side. There certainly are supposed to be enough seats in here for 222 people. In fact, if you're content there, you could sit there. If you want a seat, there's seats. Okay. Okay. All right, where I want to pick up the story is with the issue, the battle over federal versus state power at the Constitutional Convention and thereafter, because this battle was a battle that raged in 1787, and it's a battle that still rages today in 2006. It's a battle that, for those of you who were interested enough to watch the confirmation hearings, first of John Roberts a couple of months ago, and then of Joseph Alito a couple of weeks ago, a week or two ago, is front and center, has been front and center, both around sort of the division of labor between the federal government and the states, and also around the extent of executive and presidential power versus legislative and congressional and state power. So it's a battle that was important then, and it's a battle that's important now, and it's a battle that over the last couple of hundred years has gone through a series of evolutions and changes. Let me start out by saying that there were back then, and in many respects I think there are today, three fundamentally different views on the issue. On one extreme, at one end of the balancing act, I guess you could say, was Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, very bright guy, 30 years old at the time of the Constitutional Convention. By that point, he already had been George Washington's number one aide. He'd already been a military hero. He already had all sorts of, you know, brilliant writings as a lawyer and, in effect, as an economist. And Hamilton was convinced that in order for the United States, in order for these 13 colonies to become the national economic power, to become the world class power, to become the single unified nation that he believed we could and should become, you needed to have a very strong federal government fueled by a powerful executive branch, fueled by a powerful presidency, and that the states, I mean, there are some folks who say Hamilton basically wanted to get rid of the states. You know, he had no time for local discretion, for local authority, for local power, for local control. His view was that we were small enough and yet had the potential for growth enough that it made perfect sense for there to be a powerful federal government, weak states, and a strong presidency. In fact, he proposed, although it was never given serious consideration, he proposed at the Constitutional Convention that, in effect, the President and the Senate be allowed to serve for life once they were elected. That, in effect, they could have life tenure on good behavior. So there were those who have said, you know, and from the beginning, he was painted by some as being sort of in favor of creating sort of a new monarchy here in the colonies. Of course, there were those who said he saw himself as just the perfect person to occupy that position. But he really believed strongly you needed a powerful executive branch. and a powerful federal government in order to have a world-class nation. So he was at one end of the extreme. James Madison, young Virginian, James Madison had a very different view. Madison also wanted a large national government, but he wanted that large national government to be relatively weak. For Madison, the problem was that in the states at that point, you had all these little legislatures out there passing laws, repealing laws, passing taxes, repealing taxes, and there was in effect chaos. For Madison, in a certain sense, the problem was all this action in the states that was creating uncertainty and chaos, and the solution was stalemate. And so how do you get stalemate, according to Madison, if you want a large national government? How do you make it hard for that large national government to do anything? Anybody? Excuse me?
Bureaucracy.
Checks and balances. You basically say, we want to make it difficult for any particular branch of this large national government to act. We want to have two branches in Congress. Some people were saying, let's just have a single branch in Congress. Madison would have been happy with three, but at least two branches of Congress. A law has to pass both of them, then it's got to be signed by a president. He has the power to veto. It's hard to overturn the veto. Then you've got the courts, so you've got the states, you've got the federal government, you've got federalism, you have checks and balances, you have division of power. Again, the problem was not too much action for Madison. He wanted a large republic in which it was difficult to act, difficult to pass laws. Institutionally, difficult to make things happen of a significant consequence, significant degree. And again, he thought the problem in the states was that small groups, what he called factions, but small groups of individuals could basically band together and rule the roost. And he wanted to create a system in which it was very difficult for factions, what he called factions, or what you today might call interest groups, to get their own legislation enacted into law, to get their own policies enacted into law. So you've got Hamilton, who wants a large national government fueled by a powerful executive with relatively few checks and balances, in which the president and the executive branch is able to take the lead and get a lot of stuff done. You've got Madison, who agrees that we want a large national government, but who wants to make it very difficult for that large national government to act. And then you have what are known as the anti-federalists, the Patrick Henrys, the Thomas Jeffersons. And those folks basically said, you know what? We don't want a large national government. Number one, because we're afraid Hamilton's going to be in charge. You know, if we give this national government too much power, he's exactly our biggest nightmare, and exactly why we don't want to give the kind of authority to the presidency and the kind of authority to the federal branch that Hamilton wants. And again, you see this debate today in the scope of presidential power. You know, should the president be enabled, authorized in a time of war to get wiretaps against American citizens without a warrant? How much power should the president have, whether it's war or not war? Hamilton, and as we'll see as we go through American history, Franklin Roosevelt wanted a strong national government fueled by a powerful president. Madison, much more focused on checks and balances. The anti-federalists, much more focused on states' rights, on local government, on democratic institutions, on New England town democracy. They didn't want a president in charge. In fact, the Anti-Federalists, they didn't want the Constitution ratified at all. And if there was going to be a Constitution, and they boycotted the Constitutional Convention, then they worked to defeat it in the ratification process. And if there was going to be a president, they didn't want one president. They wanted at least two or three presidents, in which maybe one would have authority over domestic policy, one would have authority over international policy. Again, their idea was to scale back the scope of national power. And while the Madisons and the Hamiltons wanted sort of national elites to rule the roost, the Anti-Federalists wanted citizen politicians. They wanted term limits. They wanted the farmers to come in for a year or two, or the business people to come in for a year or two, and then go back to the business or go back to the farm. So three fundamentally different approaches. Sort of the Hamiltonian approach, the Madisonian approach, and the Anti-Federalist approach. And those three fundamentally different approaches are still with us today. They're still with us today in 2006. You've still got battles over states' rights versus national power. You've still got battles over presidential authority versus congressional authority. You've still got battles between checks and balances versus, you know, the ability to act in time of crisis. You've still got these kind of battles today. And you see it particularly in the healthcare arena, which is one of the things we'll be coming to over the next 13 weeks. During the debates themselves, Madison and Hamilton essentially agree to disagree. They agree on a framework in the Constitution which enables both of them to feel like they're getting what they want. Madison looks at the Constitution and says, you know what? We've got checks and balances in the Constitution. We have federalism in the Constitution. We have state power, federal power in the Constitution. We have courts, we have Congress, we have president power. You know, we've got all the checks and balances I want. I'm happy. You know, we've got the large national government. I'm getting exactly what I want, says Madison. So he signs off to this agreement. Hamilton looks at the Constitution and says, you know what? That Madison, nice guy, but kind of a fool. I mean, he didn't quite say that. But, you know, he's naive. He's naive, Hamilton thought. While there may be checks and balances on paper, Hamilton thought once the new government is put in place, once George Washington is elected president, it's going to be clear. It's going to be clear that the powers of the presidency laid out in the Constitution are by far superior to the powers of the other branches. And that indeed the national government, fueled by the executive branch, is going to rule American politics from here on out. So they both look at the Constitution, which if you read it, and I have a copy here, and it's actually interesting and worthwhile to read. And if you read the Constitution, you will see that it is extraordinarily vague in lots and lots of areas. There were, as in any contract, not any contract, but when there's divisions between parties over the language to be inserted in a contract, and I can say this with experience as a lawyer, when there's division over language of a contract, oftentimes the parties will punt and put in relatively vague language that enables each to go home feeling like they're the victor, and then they'll battle it out in the courts, so they'll battle it out at some future point. Similarly, when there's legislative battles over the language of legislation, often that language will be written in fairly vague terms, and they'll leave to bureaucracies or to regulators or to courts or to others the task of figuring out exactly what was meant by a particular piece of legislation. So Madison and Hamilton agree on the Constitution. And the question then becomes, can it be ratified? To be ratified, it had to be approved by 9 of the 13 colonies. and at that point it would take effect. And that was by no means certain, by no means clear, by no means a sure thing. I mean, they didn't have back then the kind of polling that we have today, obviously. They didn't have back then, you know, email and podcasts and audios and TV and high-speed internet. So nobody knew exactly what most people thought about these kind of issues. But the general consensus of most historians, anyway, is that most Americans in this kind of rural agrarian society that we certainly still had in 1787 were very wary about transferring all sorts of power to a new national government, were very concerned about the framework of the new Constitution, certainly considered themselves Virginians or Georgians before they considered themselves Americans, whatever that meant, and were probably opposed. There were fierce battles in a number of the states over ratification. Ironically, among the fiercest battles were battles that took place in New York and Virginia. New York, the home of Hamilton, and Virginia, the home of Madison. In New York, there was a governor named George Clinton who was a fierce anti-federalist, and who opposed vociferously the Constitution, and who opposed vociferously and was an arch-enemy of Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had a lot of arch-enemies. He ended up, as you know, getting shot in a duel by Aaron Burr and killed a few years later. Aaron Burr was the sitting vice president at the time. I mean, it was, you know, times were different back then. You know, they had to be tough back then. You know, these days, these politicians, you know, they don't have duels or anything. But Hamilton and Clinton battled, and New York was one of the last states to ratify the Constitution. In Virginia, you had Madison, but you had Patrick Henry, among the fiercest of the and most popular of the anti-federalists, dead set against the Constitution. Dead set against it. Virginia was one of the last states. So ironically, Virginia and New York were not among the first nine. Let me see if I have. I think I have somewhere here. I mean, the first states to ratify, the first five were Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Georgia. And what brings those five states together? They were among the smallest. They were like the five smallest of the 13. The perception was that this was a particularly good deal for the small states, that they preserved and protected themselves in the bargaining. Then came Massachusetts, and then New Hampshire, Maryland, and South Carolina made nine. At that point, New York, Virginia, Rhode Island, and whoever else, you know, there was a new country at that point under this new constitution, and it was sort of up to the other states to join or be out. And of course, the fear was, even if the state was opposed, if they didn't join, if now there was this new nation with 9 or 10 or 11 of these states combined together, and you, Rhode Island, or you, New York, were just sitting out there by yourself as a separate nation, of course the fear was one day you would be taken over by this new United States of America. So ultimately, all 13 went along, although in many cases reluctantly so. And in fact, New York and Virginia only went along after there was a guaranteed promise of a Bill of Rights being added to the Constitution, which happened shortly thereafter. So the Constitution is finally ratified. And in 1788, as Hamilton predicted, George Washington is unanimously elected president by the electors. And it's kind of interesting because despite the fierce opposition to a strong national government and a strong president, George Washington was probably as close to a king as we've ever had in the United States. He was this universally beloved hero, you know, viewed as the father of the nation, the savior of the nation during the war, you know, and there was no question, absolutely no question, he was going to be the first president
elected, and indeed that happened in 1788. Now, Washington, as president, wanted to view himself as above the fray of this political battle between Madison and Hamilton and Jefferson and the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. He was sort of just, he viewed himself as, you know, sort of a great man who was just going to lead the country in a nonpartisan way. You know, we didn't need all this partisan bickering. And he viewed himself as nonpartisan, nonpolitical, just sort of a leader in that sense. And so what Washington decided is he needed sort of the greatest minds of America in his administration. And so he appoints to run the economy as Secretary of the Treasury his old buddy Alexander Hamilton. And he appoints to run the State Department as Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. So those two guys become the two leading figures in Washington's administration. And they completely hated each other. And they completely saw the future of American politics in fundamentally different ways on almost every issue you can imagine. Hamilton, as I said a few minutes ago, wanted a strong national government, a powerful president. He wanted a national bank that would basically run the economy. He wanted the federal government to assume the debt of all the states so that there would just be a single national debt. He wanted one single national currency. He wanted a national army. He wanted a national bureaucracy. He wanted to federalize much of the nation. And in addition to that, when it came to foreign affairs, he wanted to align the United States with Great Britain. Jefferson, the Secretary of State, disagreed with Hamilton in all of those areas. Jefferson was an anti-federalist. He wanted a small, relatively weak national government. He didn't think we needed a national army. He didn't want a national bureaucracy. He didn't want a national bank. He didn't want any national taxing power. Hamilton wanted national taxing power. And he hated Great Britain. And what he wanted was for the United States to align itself with France and the French Revolution. So in every possible arena, Hamilton and Jefferson were on opposite poles. Madison, one of the other great leaders of the day, aligns himself with Jefferson. I mean, he breaks up his deal. Remember, during the framing of the Constitution, Madison had aligned himself with Hamilton to get the Constitution ratified. But now that it was ratified, he wanted the Constitution interpreted in more of a Jeffersonian fashion. So Madison lines up with Jefferson. John Adams, who was the vice president, lines up more on the Hamilton camp. And so you get these two camps. You've got Washington at the top, who's trying to be nonpartisan, nonpolitical, apolitical, just, you know, let's just all get along. And then underneath Washington, you've got these battles really beginning to brew between Jefferson and his camp, Hamilton and his camp. And that is the beginning of the two-party system in the United States. The two-party political system in the United States. Hamilton and Adams form what becomes known as the Federalist Party. And they believe in all the things that I just said that Hamilton believed in. Strong national government, strong army, strong bureaucracy, strong banks, strong economy, and Great Britain. Jefferson and Madison form what's known as the Republican Party. And they believe in all the things that I just said Madison believed in. Jefferson. States' rights, limited government, no national army, no national taxing power, and alliances with France. for the first few years, Washington, and there were no political parties before this, but for the first few years, Washington is able, in effect, to paper over the differences between these two adversaries. Indeed, Washington wanted to retire after serving one term in office in 1792. He wanted to retire, but it was clear that there was too much animosity, and both sides, both Adams and Hamilton and Jefferson and Madison, urged Washington to run again in 1792 just to keep things together, because the country was in a very, very, very fragile state at that point. So Washington is reelected in 1792, unanimously. But then things begin to even get tough for Washington. In 1793, France declares war on Great Britain. And France wants the United States as an ally in that war. Basically, France's attitude is, look, you know, 5-10 years ago, when you were fighting Great Britain, when you were fighting for independence, we made it possible for you to win. We gave you the money, we gave you Lafayette, we gave you the troops, we gave you, you know, some of the key victories in the war. We made it possible for you to win, and now it's payback time. Now you have to support us against Great Britain. But again, clearly remember, Hamilton and the Federalists were much more on the British side than they were on the French side in this debate, in this battle. And so Washington in 1793 issues what he calls neutrality proclamation, basically saying, you know what, we're not going to take sides. Of course, that infuriates everybody. And Washington really is getting just tired of the whole thing at this point. France and Britain keep battling. You know, underneath Washington, there's increasing animosity between Jefferson and Hamilton and the others. And finally, Washington says, I've had enough. I want to go back to Mount Vernon. I want to go back to my farm. I'm old. I'm tired. I want to just, like, you know, hang out and watch TV. So that's what Washington says. And so the question is, what's going to happen next? So in 1796, Adams says, well, geez, you know, I'm the heir apparent, I'm the vice president, you know, it's time for me to take over. And he runs against Jefferson. And so you have the first partisan political battle in American history. Very close election, Adams wins, Federalists stay in power. Adams has a very tough, very tumultuous 4 years in power. Relations, particularly abroad, become very risky, very dangerous. We become very close to having war again, first with Britain and then with France. Politics becomes vicious. In 1798, Congress enacts and Adams signs something that he later regrets, called the Alien and Sedition Acts, which, in addition to making it very tough for French immigrants and others to come to the United States, also make it essentially a crime to criticize the federal government. A lot of reporters and a lot of editors and newspapers, Republican reporters who had attacked Adams, are thrown in jail. Again, you may have heard a lot about the Alien and Sedition Acts shortly after 9/11, when there were debates about what sort of response was appropriate on the part of the national government in a time of crisis like that. Jefferson and Madison become so upset by the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts that they get the legislatures in Virginia and Kentucky to pass laws saying they are not bound by those federal laws, by the Alien and Sedition Acts. They promulgate a doctrine known as nullification, which basically suggests that the states have the right to nullify federal laws that they view as contrary to the Constitution. Very, very, very controversial approach. But the Republicans basically despise Adams at this point. we become very close to having war with France. Adams, to the chagrin of the Federalists, ultimately works out a treaty with the French, which avoids war, but also probably in a certain respect costs him the presidency, because Republicans already hated him, you know, for his sort of Federalist actions and the Alien and Sedition Acts, etc. And Hamilton and the Federalists view him as sort of weak and weak-willed, you know, for not taking on the French and for working out this agreement with the French. Adams runs again in 1800, but the Federalists don't support him to any great degree. And even though it's a close election, Thomas Jefferson is elected president in 1800. And that becomes one of the most important elections in American history, that election of 1800. Why? Well, first of all, it becomes one of the first times in world history, that a government in power voluntarily leaves power because it lost an election. I mean, that was pretty much unprecedented in world history. I mean, Adams and the Federalists didn't want to leave power. And yet, because they lost this election, they agreed to. And so that really is, in a certain sense, the birth of the American Republic as a functioning democracy, in which power really does shift based on results of the ballot box. The other reason, or another reason, why the election of 1800 is so fundamentally important is Jefferson comes in and he fundamentally reshapes the political culture of the American society. He basically says, you know what, the Hamiltonian view, the Federalist view, that we want a national bureaucracy, a national army, a national bank, national taxing authority, you know, that view is contrary to what is at the heart of the American political culture, says Jefferson. At heart, American political culture is about states' rights, is about limited government, is about government as a necessary evil that ought to have limited powers, and he moves systematically and methodically to cut the size of the army, to cut the size of the navy, to cut the size of the bureaucracy, to cut the size of national taxes, federal taxes. He moves systematically to shift where he can the locus of power and authority, philosophically and substantively, away from Washington, D.C., even though it wasn't Washington, D.C. then, but away from the national capital, back to the state capitals, back to the local governments, back to the anti-federalist philosophy. And that view, the Jeffersonian view of government, dominates American political discourse and dominates American political culture and dominates American public policy from 1800 until 1935. Until 1935, when Franklin Roosevelt gets the New Deal enacted, which we're going to talk about next week. So in that context, in which really beginning in 1800 and running for the next 130, 140 years, you've got a limited federal authority, limited federal power, limited state power, and power rooted at the state and local level. The question then becomes, what kind of social welfare system, what kind of health care system, what kind of income support system, what kind of aid system should we, will we, can we have in this new nation? What are the obligations of government to the poor, to the needy, to the indigent, to the sick, to the disabled, to those unable to take care of themselves. Where should that responsibility lie? Who should have the authority? And how should they have the ability to exercise that authority? Just to give you one example, in the mid-1800s, a reformer in the mental health arena named Dorothea Dix was very anxious to build all sorts of new state institutions for the mentally retarded and the developmentally disabled. So Dix goes to Congress and says, you know what? You, Congress, should give us some federal land and we'll build these state institutions on this federal land. The president at that time was Franklin Pierce, and Pierce vetoed the bill of Congress giving Dix and the states some federal land, the hospitals for the mentally retarded. And in his veto message, Pierce writes, if the Congress has the power to make provision for the indigent insane, in other words, if the Congress has the constitutional and political power to do something on behalf of the indigent insane, then the whole field of public beneficence is thrown open to the care and culture of the federal government. I readily acknowledge, says Pierce, the duty incumbent on us all to provide for those who in the mysterious order of providence are subject to want and to disease of body or mind. But I cannot find any authority in the Constitution that makes the federal government the great almoner of public charity throughout the United States. To do so would, in my judgment, be contrary to the letter and the spirit of the Constitution and be prejudicial rather than beneficial to the noble offices of charity. So basically, during the entire 19th century and first third of the 20th century, the federal government basically takes the position, we do not have the ability, the authority, the responsibility. We are constitutionally prohibited from engaging in action to try to deal with those who are indigent, who are disabled. That is a state and local function. Throughout the 19th century, about the only thing that the federal government did in the social welfare arena was provide a pension to some veterans of the Revolutionary War and a pension to some veterans of the northern side of the Civil War. And in the healthcare arena, about the only thing that the federal government does is to create some small clinics to provide healthcare to members of the Merchant Marines or the Navy. You know, basically sort of a predecessor to almost a VA hospital type situation. You know, essentially saying we can provide some health care benefits to people who serve for us in the Army or the Navy, but that's about it. And that's about the entire scope of the federal role in social welfare prior to the New Deal. What about the states? Well, the states, mid-19th century, for a variety of reasons, get a little bit involved on behalf of the developmentally disabled and the mentally retarded, and they carve out that niche for themselves, largely because of Dorothea Dix and some other reformers. And in fact, today, if you look around, about the only hospitals and healthcare facilities that the states run in 2006 in the United States, facilities on behalf of the mentally ill and the developmentally disabled, And so that begins mid-19th century, and that's about it for the states. That's about it for the states during that period of time. So just like back then and today, what do the feds do? Well, they have some hospitals, and today they have the VA system, and back then the states had the facilities for the MR population, which they still do. That's about it. Local governments then are given the responsibility, the authority, the power to deal with and provide for the indigent of their own communities. And at this point, here in the United States, we find a political philosophy, a political program from Great Britain, which we adopt. The so-called Elizabethan poor law approach. In Great Britain and in the United States during this period of time, care for the indigent, to the extent it's provided at all, is provided by local governments, by county governments. Initially, local governments who have the option, I mean, there is no requirement that local governments provide health care or income security or aid of any sort to any of the indigent or disabled or anybody else in need. But local governments take it upon themselves in the 17th century, in the 18th century, in early 19th century, take it upon themselves to provide care to those who they view as part of their own community. So, for example, local governments create systems of so-called home relief, providing some financial assistance to poor people in their communities. Local governments create systems which, and those systems of home relief became the predecessors of what we would today call welfare, cash assistance welfare. Local governments sometimes say to poor people in their community, you know, who they view as coming into their community from the outside, you gotta leave. You can't stay here anymore. If you can't support yourself and you're not from here, you can't stay here. And they would physically pick people up, just like the sheriff picking people up and taking them to the border and saying you're on your own. So a philosophy developed in which local government said, we will take care of our own to the extent we can, but we're not taking care of anybody outside of our borders. And we'll take care of people here either through home relief, or sometimes we'll take kids who are orphans and we'll apprentice them off. Or we'll create what we call almshouses for the poor. And the almshouse was really the 18th century and the 19th century predecessor of today's homeless shelter. Although they were even less desirable a place to be than today's homeless shelter. They were places of last resort for the indigent, insane, for the disabled, for the elderly, for those truly on the streets with no place else to go. There was a question somewhere. Yeah. Yes. The question was, for those who couldn't hear the question on the other end of the room, the question was, what about the role of private charitable organizations and of faith-based organizations of a variety of sorts? And the answer is absolutely yes. To the extent that services were provided by non-governmental organizations, it typically was by those charitable groups. So we're going to come back to that in just a few minutes, particularly when we start talking about hospitals and the evolution of the hospital system in the United States. Yeah.
So that some places where the communities are not able to do that, some indigenous they're not provided for.
So the question was, for those who couldn't hear, where does this system of the English poor law system, where does it fit in with the constitutional framework that we just talked about that was developed. Now remember though, the constitutional framework, and remember just this quote that I read you from Franklin Pierce. What Jefferson and Madison and the Anti-Federalists were able to do in the election of 1800 was basically say, Hamilton's wrong. The federal government does not have a role to play in terms of the economy. The federal government does not have a role to play in terms of social welfare. The federal government is out of the game, and it becomes a local responsibility. And that's the way the Constitution was interpreted. That's the way it was interpreted. At that point, local governments said to themselves, how are we going to figure out what we should do and what we shouldn't do? And local governments begin by saying, we'll help people in our community, but we're not going to help people outside of our borders. And then something very important begins to happen. Local governments begin to feel overwhelmed here in New York City, in Baltimore, in Philadelphia, in cities around the country, and in small towns around the country. They begin to feel overwhelmed by the task of caring for the indigent. That's been thrust upon them in this new constitutional order. They begin to feel, we can't afford to take, you know, there's a tremendous amount of immigration to the country that's taking place. There's industrialization. There's more and more of a gap between the haves and the have-nots. There's more and more poverty. And local governments begin to say, we can't handle this all. And so what local governments then do, and this becomes the sort of second principle guiding sort of this local beneficence, local social welfare approach, local governments say, you know what, if you want aid from us, not only do you have to be part of our community, but you have to be a member of what we're going to call, quote unquote, the deserving poor. And local governments begin to divide people up into two categories, the deserving poor versus the undeserving poor. So who's the undeserving poor? Young men who are employable. Absolutely right. And that's the case in 1800, and that's the case in 2006. If you look at our welfare system and healthcare system in 2006. Who else is part of the undeserving poor? Alcoholics. Anybody who by virtue of their own action, quote unquote, their own behavior, quote unquote, has taken themselves or has put themselves outside of the labor force. So they're outside of the labor force because of their own what would be considered immoral behavior, their own inappropriate behavior, their own laziness, their own unwillingness to get a job, as opposed to the so-called deserving poor. And who's the deserving poor?
The blind.
Women and children. Basically, the deserving poor are those folks who are also outside of the labor force, but through no fault of their own, quote unquote. Perhaps they're mentally retarded, developmentally disabled. Perhaps they've been injured in some dramatic disability. Perhaps they're elderly. You know, they're 80 years old, they've worked their whole life, they can't work anymore. Whoever it is, they cannot work, and we as a society say it's okay that they're not working. As opposed to those who are out of the workforce for reasons that we consider inappropriate, immoral, or just flat out wrong. And so the American system of social welfare begins to divide and classify. And those divisions and classifications are with us as much today and become as important part of the story of the welfare system that we have today. And it's as important today as it was back then. It's as important today as it was back then. Yeah. The question was, where do runaway slaves fit into this debate? And certainly before the Civil War, there were runaway slaves. Under the Constitution, as I read to you earlier, under the law, it was the law that those slaves, to the extent they were caught, be returned to their home state. They were certainly not viewed as part of the community in Massachusetts or New York or Pennsylvania, with the exception being that if they were able to find and join and be protected by the so-called Underground Railroad or so-called systems of care for runaway slaves, which were not sort of legally sanctioned systems of runaway care, then they would be protected and preserved by those groups. And that actually brings us back to the question of somebody way in the back there about non-governmental private charitable groups and faith-based organizations. Certainly those organizations would be more likely to take care of runaway slaves and others who might fit into different categories than would be government. Although even most of the nonprofits and most of the charitable organizations generally made the same kind of distinction between deserving and undeserving in the benefits that they provided as well. Yeah. Well, it was a little different, yes and no. I mean, when it came to the right to vote, most of the truly poor never had that right to begin with here. So in that sense, and they certainly never voted, it was not as clearly, explicitly a part of the assumption of aid as it was in England. You're absolutely correct. But the de facto result was the same. The de facto result was the same. Many states had all sorts of income tests. Certainly there were racial tests, but income tests as well, and wealth tests before you were allowed to vote. And clearly the acceptance of aid in the almshouse precluded you from participating to that degree. So the system begins to evolve that local governments more and more begin to exercise their authority to create these almshouses for the poor, which provide services primarily to the deserving poor. Those almshouses to the poor, over time, create small clinics, medical clinics, to provide healthcare services to the members of the almshouse, to the residents of the almshouse. Those clinics, those almshouse clinics, evolve over time into public hospitals, or what we would call public hospitals today. So, for example, Bellevue Hospital, which I'm sure many, if not all of you, are familiar with here in Manhattan. Bellevue Hospital begins as a clinic to the New York Almshouse. And so if you look at the public hospital system in the United States, public hospitals are not run by state governments. What we call public hospitals, meaning general acute care facilities that provide services to whoever walks in the door. I mean, the federal government runs hospitals for veterans, and that's it. If you're not a veteran or in the Army, you can't go to a veterans facility. The states run hospitals for the indigent, well, not just for the indigent, but for the developmentally disabled and the mentally retarded, but that's it. They don't run general acute care facilities. And this system isn't in New York. This is everywhere in the country. Public hospitals, when we say the term public hospitals, we're generally referring to general acute care facilities that treat whoever walks in the door. Those are locally run facilities, whether it's in New York City or Philadelphia or Chicago or Detroit or Los Angeles. And so the first public hospitals started as clinics related to the almshouse. So that became one of the ways that local governments exercise their authority, exercise their power, exercise their responsibility to provide social welfare services to the poor people in their community. Again, they started out by making these distinctions between deserving and undeserving, and over time, we're talking, again, remember, from 1800 to 1935 is the period we're talking about here, over that 135-year period, slowly evolved into a situation where they were taking on more and more of the responsibility for caring for the indigent in their own community. The other thing that local governments did in the 18th century and in the 19th century, the other thing that local governments did, and we're going to come back to this because we're going to spend a full week on this. Not the whole week. It'll only be 3 hours 1 week, but we're going to spend time on this later in the semester. The other thing that governments did was it began to create systems of public health. It was the local government's responsibility to deal with the food quality, with the water quality, with the sewage quality. It was the local government's responsibility to deal with the extraordinary rates of infectious disease, the smallpox, the cholera, the TB. Local governments had to figure out how to quarantine, how to deal with these horrendous epidemics, which, as I said, we're going to talk about when we talk about public health and emergency response later in the semester. That became initially and primarily a local function. So there are today, for example, in the United States, over 3,000 local public health departments. Just about every community in the country has its own local public health department, which provides a range of public health services to the members of that community. It initially was not a state function, and it really still isn't a state function, although there are certainly state health departments. It initially was not a federal function, and it still really is not a federal function, even though you've got the CDC in Atlanta, and you've got the Office of Homeland Security, and you have all this other stuff that we're going to talk about later in the semester when it comes to public health and emergency preparedness. Public health began as a local community-based responsibility, local community-based obligation. It was not the federal role. It was not the state role. It was a local role. And then added to the local role, you had the beginnings of some charitable groups, some faith-based groups. So you had some hospitals. I mean, for example, just to give you a sense of numbers, in in 1873, there were less than 200 hospitals in the United States. They were not places you wanted to go to if you could avoid it. There were places you basically went to die, for reasons we'll talk about in just a couple of minutes. But most of those hospitals were either public hospitals run by local communities or faith-based, religiously affiliated hospitals run by nonprofit organizations that were trying to provide a service to the poor and their communities. They were facilities for the poor and the indigent and the disabled, and they were places that people generally avoided if they could. So the question then became, if the feds are not involved in the system, if the state's not involved in the system, if the local government is involved to a limited extent, a few public hospitals, a few clinics, a few almshouses, a couple of public health laws, but that's basically it. If that's the system, what kind of health care system is going to evolve in that context? What kind of health care system is going to evolve in that context? First thing to note is that healthcare generally was extraordinarily rudimentary at that period of time. It was non-scientifically based, by and large. There were lots and lots and lots of folks who called themselves doctors who went to one of hundreds of medical schools in the 18th century or 19th century that were unregulated, unlicensed, unsupervised, but could produce men or women who call themselves doctors. You didn't even have to go to a medical school to call yourself a doctor. You can apprentice, and many people did, to a doctor, and then call yourself a doctor. So there were lots of doctors. There were lots of so-called medicine men, sort of went from community to community selling their little potions. There were lots of faith healers. There were midwives. There were abortionists. I mean, there was a virtual Wild West of providers of care, none of whom had a particularly scientific basis for the exercise of their activities, all of whom charged relatively small fees because it was a non-prestigious, non-scientifically based, you know, service that was provided. Government was not involved. It was unregulated. Anybody could pretty much call themselves a doctor. Anybody can call themselves a faith healer. Anybody can call themselves a medicine man. Anybody can go from town to town and sell their wares, and did. Government said, you know what, it is not our role to be involved. When it comes to health care, we, the federal government, have no role at all. No such thing as the Federal Drug Administration or any of that stuff till the 20th century. We, the states, it's not our role. And we, local governments, well, maybe it's our role to a limited extent, but it's only our role to the extent that we're going to provide some basic public health services and some basic almshouse and public hospital services. When it comes to regulating and supervising the care received by the average middle class, working class, upper class American, we, the states, we, the federal government, we, the local government, have no role to play. It's completely buyer beware. It's completely a commodity sold on a market between an individual and a provider of care. In that context, most people, most Americans, didn't bother buying health care, quote unquote, from any of those folks, from doctors, midwives, or any of them. What they did instead, primarily through the 18th century and 19th century, what they did instead, primarily, was rely on informal healing techniques that had been handed down from generation to generation, typically by the women in the family, who would sort of just take care of people to the extent they could. There also was a relatively short gap between disability and death. There also was a society in which people lived in relatively close proximity to their other family members. You didn't have families in which, I have one sister in France and another sister who lives in Seattle, you know, and that's sort of my family. You know, and that's not at all typical in the year 2006 for many Americans to have just families scattered all over the country, if not all over the world. Back then, again, remember, as I said, in the 18th century, 95% of Americans were farmers. Now, surely during the 19th century, you had the Industrial Revolution, you had immigration, you had changes, urbanization, etc. But still, you by and large had relatively tight communities in which families, to the extent they could, took care of their family members through non-scientific, non-technical approaches. And to the extent that they wanted to buy some services from anybody, they bought them, you know, on a buyer-beware attitude, with a buyer-beware attitude from the local quote-unquote doctor, local quote-unquote nurse, local quote-unquote faith healer. This all begins to change late in the 19th century. And I suppose you could say the late 19th, early 20th century are dominated by two primary features. Number one is the rise of the physician, and number two is the rise of the hospital. Now, the rise of the physician takes place for two reasons. Number one, because there's a series of scientific advancements, whether it's the x-ray or antiseptics or antibiotics or anesthesia. I mean, there's a series of scientific advances which the doctor, which the physician lays claim to the scientific nature and the ability to provide that service. And the doctor convinces the regulators at the state level, not at the federal level, but at the state level for the first time, to begin to regulate who can engage in these new technologies, who could use these new technologies. And the doctors say to the regulators, you know what, you can't let anybody use anesthesia, you can't let these faith healers use anesthesia, you can't let these midwives use anesthesia, you can't let these abortionists use x-rays. You need the scientific training that we as doctors have. And the doctors themselves early in the 19th century changed the way medical education is run here in the United States to try to get rid of all these unlicensed, unaccredited, incompetent medical schools and provide a scientific basis in a hospital-based setting to the practice and the training of physicians. And so state regulators not only say, yes, doctors, you're right, you've got this knowledge and nobody else has it, but state regulators for the first time in the late 1800s begin to say to these other providers, you can't practice anymore in our community. You can't practice any. You can't be a midwife. You can't be an abortionist. You can't be a faith healer. You can't be a medicine man. You can't be an osteopath. You can't be any of these things other than what we, state government, define as a good practitioner of medicine, which is a physician or perhaps a nurse. That leads to the rise of the doctor and the increasing role of the states. For the first time, the states in regulating the practice of medicine. Sort of a deal is struck between the medical providers, the doctors, and the states. And that deal has a fundamental impact and will be something we'll be talking about over the much of the rest of this semester. Second thing that happens is the rise of the hospital. And this is truly an extraordinary, extraordinary change that takes place. In the 1700s and the 1800s, the hospital was the place you wanted to avoid. Nobody wanted to go to a hospital if they could help it. The care was unprofessional, unscientific. The conditions were horrific, unhygienic. Nobody wanted to go there if they could avoid it. And only the poorest of the poor, the neediest of the needy, ended up there. Let me just give you a couple of numbers in terms of the growth of the hospital. In 1873, as I said, there were less than 200 hospitals in the United States. Most of those, too, were either state facilities for the developmentally disabled, or these few public hospitals, or these few charitable hospitals. But less than 200 hospitals. In 1900, so I guess you could say from 1787, ratification of the Constitution, 1873, for that 100-year, 90-year period, less than 200 hospitals. In the year 1900, 4,000 hospitals with 35,000 hospital beds. In the year 1930, 7,000 hospitals with 922,000 hospital beds. So we went in this country from a situation in 1900 where we had 35,000 hospital beds across the country to 30 years later in 1930, 922,000 hospital beds across the country. That's really an amazing statistic. Just an amazing, amazing statistic. I can't get over it, actually. In 1998, we had 840,000 hospitals. We've gone down from where we were in 1930. So the question is, why such dramatic, dramatic growth in the number of hospitals in the United States? What do you think? Anybody have a guess? Yes. Yeah. Excuse me? World Wars, although those were really, again, remember by 1900, we had 4,000. I mean, the growth really began late 1800s. Excuse me?
Antibiotics.
Antibiotics. So clearly one thing was the scientific advances, antibiotics, x-ray, anesthesia, and it's related to what I just said before about the rise of the medical profession. Clearly, late 1800s, early 1900s, is all these new things that doctors can do. And where could doctors do them? They do them in the hospital setting. So for the hospital becomes the place where the doctor is able to provide this kind of care. And so that becomes one very important, this new technology is one very important reason for the rise of the hospital. What else? Any other ideas? Yeah. I think what you said was just with the massive urbanization of society, and that's absolutely correct. As society, as the country grew, as immigration grew, and as urbanization grew, you had increasing concentration to population. You had a breakup of the old sort of agrarian style system. You had a breakup of the old family informal care network, and you had increasing need in these high concentrations of population arenas for facilities. So urbanization and industrialization was clearly also a factor. Any other ideas? Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. The comment was, what about change in the way people perceive the hospital? And there's no question that was the case. Part of that was related to the rise of the nursing profession in addition to the medical profession, doctors. Nurses, beginning in the mid-19th century, began to be trained professionally. You had the first nursing schools, Florence Nightingale, all that stuff. And the hygienic condition in the hospitals began to improve dramatically. And in addition to the improved hygienic conditions with the nurses, you had these improved systems of care with doctors providing care. So all of a sudden, the hospital, instead of being the place you wanted to avoid at all costs, the hospital became the place where you got the latest and most advanced scientific care. So culture and perception changed dramatically. So, yeah. Absolutely, and that's sort of connected also with the comment about industrialization and urbanization. There's no question that the combination of urbanization, industrialization, increased population, immigration, rise of the nursing profession, rise of the medical profession, changes in the practice of medical education, all of those things led to this unbelievable growth in the rise of the number of hospitals in the country. And there also was money. In the 1910s and 1920s, the economy was strong. Hospitals became the dot-com investment of the period. You know, if you had a little bit of money, invest it in a hospital. Build a hospital. That became the perceived way that you can actually make some money. Yeah. Well, let me give you an example, and let me sort of answer your question by saying with the following comment. From 1900 to 1930, you had this dramatic growth, as I said. So that by 1930, you had 922,000 beds here in the United States. 1929, though, what happened in 1929? Stock market crashes. 1930, the depression begins. Now to answer your question, between 1929 and 1930, the average receipt per hospital per patient drops from $236 per patient. So that's what the average hospital was getting in 1929 per patient, to $59 in 1930. So hospital revenue on average drops from $236 to $59. Now again, those are 1929 and 1930 dollars, and I haven't, you know, adjusted for inflation and all that stuff. I mean, clearly, it's not what they were getting today. But part of what was going on then, and I guess this is the other part of the answer to the question that I should give you, is that in 1929, when hospitals were getting $259 from the average patient, there was no health insurance. People were paying that bill out of their pocket. Middle-class folks were paying that bill. Upper-class folks were saying, all right, the hospital is a cool place to go. It's where I want mom to get her care, or I want my kid to get his care, and I will scrap together the money to pay that $259 on average for her. No insurance. People pay out of pocket. It's a commodity. It's fee-for-service.
You pay what the hospital charges. You have to take out your wallet and pay the bill. 1930, all of a sudden hospitals are down to $59 for a patient. And not only that, it's tougher for people to pay the $59 in 1930 than it was for people to pay the $259 in 1929. So it's, again, you've got like this dot-com burst in 1930. You go from a situation where you've got this extraordinary, unbelievable growth, you know, you're practically a million new beds across the country, you know, revenue up, investment up, all the stuff, you know, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, to now big trouble, $59, hospitals all over the place are in danger of going bankrupt in 1930, and many do go bankrupt. So the question then becomes, how is the hospital going to survive? We've got these sort of two paths going, two trains crossing in very different directions. In this direction, you've got all these new technologies, these new sciences, there's more professional hospitals, there's more hygienic conditions, these better places that people want for the first time. So the demand for hospital care is just extraordinary, and it's growing, and it's great, and it's terrific. Beginning in 1930, however, the ability of people to pay for that care is down the tubes. And all of a sudden, the ability for that industry, which had created itself essentially overnight, that industry to create and is leveraged to the hilt, you know, is mortgaged to the hilt, is in risk of foreclosure to the hilt, that whole industry is suddenly at risk. It's finally at risk. And so that becomes sort of the policy paradox, the management paradox. How are we as a society going to solve that? The demand for hospital care growing, the ability to pay for hospital care, and the ability of hospitals to survive financially down the tubes. So what I'm going to do is stop there. Next week we're going to talk, the 30-second answer is private health insurance and Blue Cross and so on and so forth. But you've got some readings to do on that. So next week we're going to start with the evolution of the private health insurance system. We're going to talk about... No one's listening to me anymore. I lost you all. All right, I'll see you next week. All right.